Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Laura Brennan Rodriguez, coordinator of the San Francisco Department of Public Health's Feeling Good Project. It is now my pleasure to introduce our guest, Julia Ross, author of The Mood Cure and Diet Cure and CEO of Recovery Systems. By way of introduction, Julia Ross has shared with me that more than 180 million overweight Americans find dieting a failure. Yet Diet Cure author Julia Ross, MA-MFT, a national expert in the fields of addiction and eating disorders, has had 25 years of success. How? She has solved the mystery at the core of a weight gain epidemic. Why can't we stay away from weight-promoting foods? In place of willpower and low calories, Ross has developed a systematic nutritional overhaul of our addictive appetite chemistry. Her revolutionary approach started with her clinic's discovery that brain-targeted amino acid supplements could turn off food cravings and emotional eating overnight. She combined this with new insights into the dangers of dieting, including how low-cal leads to high weight. A popular speaker and media expert and an educator of integrative health professionals internationally, Ross directs the staff at the Recovery Systems Clinic in Marin County, California, founded in 1988. She is the author of two best-selling books, The Mood Cure, a brain repair manual for mood and addiction problems, and The Diet Cure, with a new edition in 2012, on recovery from carbohydrate addiction. Both are now translated into several languages. She provides advanced training and certification programs in neuronutrient therapy for the treatment of chemical dependency, carbohydrate addiction, depression, anxiety, and other symptoms of neurotransmitter deficiency. She is also the founder and advisory board member of the Alliance for Addiction Solutions, an international association of treatment professionals advocating for the inclusion of effective holistic treatment strategies into the recovery field. For further information on Ms. Ross' work, visit www.recoverysystemsclinic.com or www.moodcure.com. Please welcome Julia Ross.
My first book, The Diet Cure, was published in 1999 in hardback and in 2000 in paperback, and seven publishers bid on the book. I got an enormous advance. There was great excitement in the publishing field. I had innumerable calls from publishers themselves asking for help with their weight problems. Turns out the publishing field is all women, and this is their favorite topic, not only the best-selling topic of all time for books. And The Diet Cure contained something that they knew was completely new in this unprecedented struggle that American women primarily were going through at the time with weight. We had an epidemic of eating disorders. We had an epidemic going international of diabetes as a result of our overeating. And as you'll see, that addition, although effective, very effective, and has sold, you know, over 100,000 copies and is in translation and so forth, but in spite of my best efforts, this year, the cover of Newsweek, as you see, features an infant saying, "When I grow up, I'm going to weigh 300 pounds. Help." There was no obesity epidemic when The Diet Cure was first published in 1999 and 2000. The obesity epidemic was not announced until 2002. As you know, as you probably know, infants and children do not have to grow up to be obese. At this point, our new entirely unprecedented version of malnutrition is impacting children, and there's obesity even among infants as young as 6 months. that is not uncommon now. So as I saw the problem escalating, I was consulted by a Frenchman who was among the first generation of the French to become obese. And in his 30s, he discovered my book and cured his obesity and determined to publish my book in France. He was able to get a very good deal with a French publisher, and he, in fact, did it. But in the meantime, this was 2 years ago, I had to look at the diet cure again, and I hadn't really looked at it carefully for a long time. And I saw that I had 12 years' worth of new insights to add to it, and I ended up gutting 40% of the book and publishing it again with the enthusiastic support of the publisher, who realized that the audience had grown in every sense of the word. So I'd like to start with my explanation of this impasse that we have reached, and with a reminder that it's only been since 1970 that we've had any sort of problem with weight. These are healthy, normal, happy women exposing their legs in a daring way in the 1930s, or maybe 40s. I grew up in the 60s, and I see there are other people here who probably did as well, and we were completely unacquainted with overweight. Every so often there would be a genetic problem that caused tremendous overweight, but it was freakish. These days, when I discuss the kind of diet that we consumed up to 1970, young people can't relate. We ate large meals at least three times a day, and typically snacks as well. Bedtime snack was a particular favorite in our house, for example. And yet, I struggled to keep weight on myself. I really wanted to be like Rosalind Russell, and my genes were not cooperating. When I ask young people in my audiences what they think three squares means, they really don't know. Is there anybody here who will admit to not knowing what three squares means? Yes. One young man in an audience recently said, is it like three geeks? So, just to get some perspective, we would never consider, even in the Depression, no one ever considered that it was in any way acceptable to skip a meal. And now most people skip two out of the three. This is a completely unprecedented change in the human diet. And the fact that our bodies have changed in reaction should not surprise us. So, behold the U.S. diet from 1970 to 2012. This would have been regarded by my mother as outrageous, absolutely unacceptable, and we would never eat this kind of food except maybe one dessert, you know, we had dessert maybe four times a week. And that was it for sweets. We just didn't have it, and we didn't miss it, and our bodies reflected our freedom from these kinds of foods. Sodas, caffeine, these were all rare experiences up until the 1970s. So to get perfectly graphic about what's happened in the United States, we have this image of Michelangelo's David, who I think everyone will agree is the most perfect weight anyone could be. And then we have an image, which I think is very well done, of what happened to him after 2 years in the United States. He is He has full breasts and full abdomen. This is for the radio audience, by the way. So what's happened is that the 21st century American diet here and as it's been exported worldwide has resulted in these epidemics of physical disfigurement. We are not living out our native body shapes. We can't do it and still consume the kinds of calories and the types of substances that we're eating now. But it isn't only the way we look, which is bad enough, and the weight that we drag around, which slows us down. There are health consequences that are becoming ever more clear. And I'm going to be talking a lot about them. And among them is death, an increased rate of death. Among the dying are the epidemic numbers of diabetes sufferers, both adults and children. And children as well as adults are succumbing to the illnesses associated with diabetes, like kidney damage and heart disease. This is a picture of a four-year-old whose toes have been amputated. In 2006, the World Health Organization, after 5 years of very careful study internationally about the burgeoning health epidemics worldwide, came out with one recommendation and one recommendation only, and that recommendation appeared on the front pages of every newspaper in every country in the world except in the United States. And when you see the recommendation, I think you'll understand. Their recommendation was to cut all sweetened foods to below 10% of calories for the day. So less than 250 calories per day, which is about two Cokes, two normal-sized Snickers bars. You get the picture. Because the industry is so powerful, the refined food industry is so powerful, it was another 6 years before there was, this time, a more powerful and publicized expression of concern about our diet. And it was the responsibility of a San Francisco local pediatric endocrinologist who was seeing these children that under his care who were obese, diabetic, and cancer-ridden. And he began to see that this was all correlated with what they were eating, and that the very most critical thing was the amount of sugar they were eating. In the 1930s, a Nobel Prize was won by a scientist who explained that sugar was the number one food for cancer cells, for example. And Dr. Lustig and his colleagues at UCSF were able to publish an article in the most prestigious journal in the world, but in the UK. However, the newspapers in this country picked it up because not only was he very clear in talking about the consequences of our diet, specifically our consumption of sugars, but he was also proposing some very controversial actions. He and many others now, he's been on 60 Minutes and all over the media, are proposing that we take action and limit children's access to what appears to be a drug that's at least as toxic and addictive, as I'll show you, as cocaine. The death rate for tobacco, previously, you know, the most deadly of all drugs, worldwide is 5.3 million. The death rate associated with sugar consumption worldwide is 35 million, and Dr. Lustig documents that in this article. So why are we overeating? We have lots of myths and suppositions about why we're overeating, but none of them have ever helped us. I am a psychotherapist, and I can assure you that psychotherapy only infrequently helps people to stop overeating sugar, high sugar foods and other addictive substances. Same goes for addiction to drugs and alcohol. So is it ignorance? Do we really not know that these high-calorie, nutrient-void foods are going to make us fat? No, we do know that. Ignorance is not the issue. Are we motivated? Yes, that's why so many people diet. That's why there's so much misery and self-hate among us, because people are desperate to get their natural body back. Lack of mindfulness. A journalist asked me recently, what do you think about mindful eating? And I said, I think that it's very similar to mindful heroin addiction. So just to start with, let me, you know, I hope I've introduced you to this concept that we are up against a biological imperative. This has nothing to do with willpower or self-discipline. And we got a confirmation of that from the University of Bordeaux in 2007, having done a very interesting study on the addictive nature of sugar and sugar substitutes, finding that sugar and sugar substitutes were 4 times more addictive than cocaine. So since there are at least 4 times more sugar addicts than there are cocaine addicts, we now can get a glimmer of understanding of why. Sugar is a highly refined drug substance. It bears no resemblance to the original plant any more than cocaine bears any resemblance to cocoa leaves. You know, beets, sugar cane, forget it. We've got a white powder that is as deadly as OxyContin or cocaine, and it looks like 4 times more addictive, at least. So what are the definitions of addiction? Loss of control, continued use despite adverse consequences, withdrawal symptoms, and relapse. I think you'll all agree that sugar addiction qualifies. So the site of addiction, incontrovertibly, is the brain. There is no debate about this anywhere. And whether the addiction is to sugar or cocaine or heroin or marijuana or alcohol, it's the 4 mood-promoting neurotransmitters in the brain, our serotonin, our natural inner sunshine, the catecholamines, our natural stimulants, GABA, our natural relaxer, and endorphin, our natural pleasure booster and pain protector. So the question has just been, why is the brain malfunctioning? What can we do to restore our brains to the kinds of brains that we had before 1970? What happened in 1970? We became terrified of fat. And we did an extraordinary thing as a nation. We cut our intake of fats from 45% to 35%. 45% was traditional and still is in all traditional cultures. Those traditional cultures left standing do not have weight problems with 45% fat contents. And neither did ours. We were eating tons of butter, lard, and cream in the 1960s, I can assure you, and weight was not a problem. But we became terrified because of a single study, and we began to cut our fat. But we can't cut a huge calorie source from the human diet without replacing it with something. And what did we replace it with? Sugar, primarily, and refined starches. Entenmann's comes to mind for those of you who remember the fat-free cake that everybody thought they could now enjoy with impunity. So we switched at that in the 1970s towards the kind of diet that we had to have today, which is almost entirely commercial foods and most of it refined carbohydrate, most of it sweetened. Because we are eating such nutrient-void food, our brains are now deficient in their ability to make their own appetite-regulating chemicals and the chemicals that make us feel happy without chocolate. Believe me, we're supplied with these neurotransmitters are thousands of times stronger than any drug, molecule for molecule. If we have enough of them, we don't need anything else. We don't need drug foods because we feel so good. But the less nutritious our diet, the more devoid we are in these really life-saving, appetite-regulating chemicals. And there's plenty of research on it. I don't have time to go into detail, but I want you to know that the research is continuing and increasing all over the world, showing that serotonin is deficiency is a big factor in our overeating epidemic. Endorphin deficiency, the same thing. The fact that we are hypoglycemic as a nation because we can't support level glucose with the kind of diet that we're eating now. And a lot of excitement about the factor in the brain, dopamine, a neurotransmitter that's stimulating and rewarding. Also, levels falling to the point where we must have a drug fix in order to have some temporary sense of well-being. So all of these things together help explain why the brain has changed and why it can't support us in making healthy choices in our diet. So specifically, the addictive foods are sucrose, table sugar, but we were eating that in the 60s. We just weren't eating as much of it. What's changed is that in the 70s, we added high fructose corn syrup. So besides being GMO, I don't want to talk about the election, but I want us to all say a prayer about it. High fructose corn syrup has more fructose than glucose. Instead of 50-50, as in sucrose, it's 40-60. And fructose is a whole new factor in sweetness and in illness. Other foods can have an addictive impact on some people, and I think that you will all identify with starchy foods, starchy carbs being highly addictive to some people who aren't all that interested in sweets. Chocolate, anyone? So that laughter is what I get every time I mention the word chocolate. You don't even have to eat it to get a pleasure rush from it. It's that powerful a drug. Gluten-containing grains like wheat and milk products that contain a protein called casein also turn out to have, for some people, a very powerful biochemical addictive effect. And I'll talk about that just a little bit later on. So fructose is twice as sweet as glucose, and now there's more of it than there is glucose in sweets. It's been added to the sucrose. It didn't replace sucrose. It was added so that our intake of sweetened foods has increased by 25%, of sodas by 135% since it was introduced in the 1970s. And part of its deadly health effects have to do with the fact that it generates triglycerides, which all sweets do, but they last 12 hours longer in the bloodstream, thickening the blood and contributing tremendously to our likelihood of contracting heart disease. Very serious and increasingly common liver disease, a fatty liver disease similar to what's caused by alcohol, is a consequence of fructose-specific sweetener. In addition to acting like a super sweet and affecting all of the brain sites that I talked about earlier, fructose also deregulates four satiety factors or appetite-regulating hormones in the body, insulin, leptin, ghrelin, and POMC. I won't go into what they are, but some of them suppress appetite, and the net result of this regulation is that there is no instinctive The body doesn't know that it's being invaded by fructose. It has no mechanism to protect itself as it does against glucose excesses. Something terribly important, and something that I make a huge point of in the Diet Cure, and is so important for us to understand, is that the other part, we have toxic, highly addictive sweets that are overwhelming our ability to make food choices, but we also have a tendency that's now been embedded into our diet. It's not just a temporary thing the way it used to be in the 70s, but we are dieting all the time. Aren't we? Aren't we going for low fat, low calorie, skipping meals, doing cleanses, doing fasts, trying to not eat to counterbalance the terrible foods that we are eating? And each part of this dilemma plays havoc on our health. Starvation, by any name, is terribly damaging. And when we think about the empty brain, starvation is the worst thing for supporting neurotransmitter function, right? There is nothing to build those neurotransmitters with. And then we alternate with sweets and starches, which have none of the whole nutrients that the brain needs to make these neurotransmitters. So we're shot. So it started with a fad. Twiggy was a fad. Nobody took it seriously. Nobody wanted to be like Twiggy. It was just kind of funny in the 60s. But the increasing years of starvation have resulted in the epidemics of eating disorders, and specifically in women, nutrient deficiencies rising 430% since the 60s. Blood sugar, serotonin, and thyroid levels are all impacted by low-calorie starvation by any name. And within 8 hours, we start to lose our levels, and some people's never come back. And when you lose an active, healthy thyroid, you lose your ability to sustain any weight loss because the thyroid is in charge of burning calories. And when it's turned off by a diet, it won't come back on for some people. And more that's happening. How many of you have been on a diet and ended up gaining back more weight than you ever needed to lose in the first place? I think it's universal. So the result: rebound cravings and overeating, negative moods, weight gain, eating disorders, and general health decline. So the first chapter in the Diet Cure is about how to nourish the brain back to health. The second is about how to avoid low-calorie dieting, how to learn the truth about how many calories we need. The World Health Organization is the only source of healthy information on this topic, and they say minimum, just to sustain life, 2,300 calories a day for women and 2,500 calories for males. And that's for their emergency food supply. That is not what is needed by a healthy, active person living a normal and thriving in a normal life. I don't know why that's there again. So what are neurotransmitters made of? Specifically, they're made out of protein. So these kind of foods, you know, meat, fish, eggs, cheese, are the highest sources of protein. And you can see in your own diets and the diets around you that these are foods that are left behind because they're not addictive. They're vitally needed for every tissue in the body, but they are not addictive. So if we are consuming calories from sugar and starch, we are not going to waste our calories on protein. Some people who find out this information, find out how many calories they need, eat healthy fats, and I talk about in particular the importance of getting saturated fats back into our diet to keep our appetite stable and our energy high, who get enough protein, who get the good vegetables, who get plenty of fruit and beans and tubers and other whole foods that are traditional and recognized by our body as healthful, they can turn off the cravings, you know, within a certain period of time. But it can take a year or more to build back the nutrient stores through diet alone. So many people get on Atkins, for example, which has a lot of whole food in it, but they can't sustain it. It's not a low-calorie diet, and bless his heart, but they can't sustain it. After a year, their relapse rate is just as bad as people who were going on Jenny Craig. But fortunately, we know specifically which nutrients the brain needs to make the four appetite-regulating, mood-enhancing neurotransmitters. And they are available as supplements in every health food store and most markets and pharmacies in the country. They take effect within 10 minutes and are successful in 80 to 90% of the people who use them. They don't need to be taken for life. They eliminate the cravings for sweets and starches, and at that point, people can freely choose to eat healthful food and receive the health benefits without the struggle. So, for example, the kind of craving generated by somebody who's low in serotonin, which is, by the way, twice as common among females as among males, so women just naturally have less serotonin production than males, and they diet more so that serotonin drops further. They tend to be more addictive, and so the empty calories further reduce their serotonin levels. Serotonin is our inner sunshine. I mention that because it's a scientific fact that sunshine does stimulate serotonin. So it's in the afternoon and evening, particularly in this season, the darkness reduces our serotonin access, and we tend to eat more. So I'm sure many of you identify with, well, I'm fine in the morning. I'm even okay through lunch, but it's afternoon and evening. I just can't stay away from stuff. That's because serotonin isn't there to make us feel good without it. And sugar, by a very destructive means, will force a rise in serotonin very briefly. That's its drug effect, like SSRIs, basically. This is what beautiful serotonin looks like, and this is the thing we're so deficient in. These are, we don't have a time to go through the list of symptoms of low serotonin, but just seeing how many things fall apart in terms of our mood, in terms of our cravings, in terms of our sleep, gives you an idea of how important it is to sustain our levels of serotonin. There are two nutrients, two amino acids or protein fragments that the brain can use to make more serotonin. And the liver, 5-hydroxytryptophan or simply L-tryptophan, both available now very readily, and both very, very, very effective. This is a woman who came to us with a tremendous depression and a tremendous carbohydrate addiction. She basically lay in bed all day eating sweets, but it was much worse at night. She could control it to a certain extent, the amount she ate before the late afternoon, but she was up late every night eating chocolate. Her doctor got this brain scan done and identified that she had what he called the cingulate from hell, because the archway that you see in red and white, abnormal activity in the cingulate, which is the place in the brain where most serotonin is made. And she was terribly deficient. It's all abnormal production there, and it showed up in the SPECT scan. Now, Dr. Amen was the scientist who conducted the scan. And this is what happened after 3 months on tryptophan. She was sleeping instead of eating. She didn't have cravings. Her depression had lifted, all because she was able to raise her serotonin levels so fast. And in fact, you can see that archway, that cingulate from hell, is now gone in this image of her brain 3 months later. She was so grateful and appreciative that she ended up going on a national NBC special to talk about her release from hell, really, using nutrients. There's another part of the brain, though, that produces natural opiates, our natural painkillers, the endorphins. And if we're low in those, we get drawn to the comfort foods, sugar, chocolate, pasta, and cheese being top contenders. Any kind of dough, really, too. So We're getting that beautiful chocolate laughter again because those of you who are listening to the radio can't see this gorgeous picture of this woman consuming a huge bar of chocolate with a look of ecstasy on her face. But then there are those people who are addicted to bread, that comfort food, right? Well, there's a protein in bread called gluten, and it turns out to act like an opiate, or like heroin in the brain of many people, and they cannot stop eating it. I'm sure there are many bread lovers here. So our job here is to raise endorphin levels so we don't need bread, chocolate, sugar, and so forth to get that feeling of comfort and pleasure. Then there are the milk product lovers, the cheese lovers, the ice cream lovers. Of course, that's combining sugar and ice cream, so it's doubly addictive. And then finally, we have, not finally, but among the top contenders for the responsibility for our sugar addiction is our national tendency towards hypoglycemia or low blood sugar. When blood sugar is optimal, we don't crave anything. The body says everything's fine. Don't eat anymore. You're fine. But when levels drop because we haven't eaten or we've eaten a lot of sugar and the body has said, get that sugar out of the system, and suddenly we have nothing left, the body goes into a panic. The brain has no stores of glucose, and it's particularly panicked and sends out the cry for sugar consumption. There's a particular nutrient called glutamine, which has many healing properties, including for the healing of radiation burns and other and chemotherapy burns in the intestinal tract. But we use it because it'll turn off a low blood sugar craving in 3 minutes. It tastes very good. You can open a capsule in your mouth and the craving is gone if your craving is caused by a blood sugar sag. So there are many people who have all three of these brain-centered problems, and they have to take 3 amino acid supplements. It's not a death sentence. So the Diet Cure has all of this information in this updated form, and I hope that you will buy copies for yourselves. And I had a birthday 3 years ago, and I went up to Calistoga to celebrate, and I decided to have a massage before I met my friends for dinner. And I was lying on the table, and I was asking the masseuse about the kind of oils that she used for the massage. And she said, well, you are asking interesting questions. You remind me of this woman who wrote a book that saved my life. And I said, really? And she said, yes, I had cancer. I had cancer, and it was very definitely associated with my diet and my weight. And I could not stop eating sugar and starch. And then I got this book. And now I have been 6 years cancer-free and 4 years sugar-free. And I've given away 50 copies. And I said, well, I wrote that book. You can imagine what transpired after that. I also, you know, want you to know about the Mood Cure because it goes into much more detail about the brain. The whole book's about the brain instead of 2 chapters. For those of you who are really struggling with depression, anxiety, insomnia, there are wonderful practical suggestions about how to correct your brain chemistry. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Julia Ross, author of The Mood Cure and The Diet Cure and CEO of Recovery Systems, who is discussing sugar addiction and ways we can improve our mood and quality of life through nutrition. I'm Laura Brennan Rodriguez, coordinator of the San Francisco Department of Public Health's Feeling Good Project. We'll be getting to audience questions in just a few minutes, so please start lining up at the microphones. And before we get started, we'll continue with our conversation. So What do you think of eat food, not too much, mostly plants, you know, Michael Pollan's recommendations? And also, isn't the high protein, high amino acid bad for your kidneys?
Let's take Michael Pollan first. I love Michael Pollan's work. But in fact, what we find at our clinic, you know, where we're seeing thousands over the years of people coming to us with U.S.-style malnutrition and overeating problems, is that they have to increase the amount of protein that they're getting. And they need to, despite the unsustainability of a lot of it, consume a lot of animal protein for a while. And whether how much they need to continue later as they stabilize depends on the person. But a lot of our work and a lot of the information in the Diet Cure is aimed at helping people to identify that with their roots, their gastronomic roots, that for us to thrive in terms of our body size as well as our health, we need to go back to traditional foods, and animal protein is traditional to almost every culture on the face of the earth. It's just a question of how much is available, really. What we find is people are so protein malnourished that initially they need to eat a lot, and they thrive on it, and they feel the difference. And that's really the test. You know, what diet makes you feel good? Michael Pollan doesn't understand the concept of food addiction, that you just can't decide to eat a lovely, wholesome diet. And I'm sure that's because he hasn't suffered it. You know, lots of men don't. They have higher levels of serotonin and endorphin than women do, for one thing. And they don't have PMS. I hope that's enough of an answer on that one. In terms of the kidneys, the human kidney was designed with animal protein in mind, but it does have difficulty with too much protein powder, refined proteins of that nature.
Thank you. The next question is, when you're talking about limiting sugar calories to 10%, does this include artificial sweeteners, sugar and fruit, sugar in vegetables like beets and carrots, and sugar alcohols?
It certainly includes artificial sweeteners, which are heavily implicated now in diabetes, and it's perfectly clear that they have not aided us in our fight with sweet foods. But in terms of fruit and sweet vegetables like beets, there's no restriction required there. As long as we balance our healthy carbohydrate intake with adequate protein and fat, it's lovely. It's all lovely.
Thank you. What is the effect of using Truvia or Stevia as a substitute?
You know, there isn't any research on stevia, and I myself think and advise all of our clients to just stay away from sweeteners. We don't know anything about them. Anything sweet is apt to set off the wrong chemistry in the body, anything with that kind of intense sweetness anyway. So fruit, yes, that level of sweetness, that's a safe level, although there are some people who become addicted and over-consume fruit. It's very unusual.
So with all the facts, why is the FDA not involved?
You know, I'd rather not address that, but I'd love for you to address the FDA. All of us need to address the FDA.
Well, I suspect they haven't yet classified sugar as a drug. So one other change in the 70s was the beginning of the campaign against smoking. Everyone or nearly everyone smoked in the 1950s and part of the 60s. And this questioner is saying that they knew of many people who quit smoking and gained weight. Is it possible that we have substituted one addiction for another?
Yes. Tobacco is a green drug. It can affect all the neurotransmitters in the brain. You know, it's relaxing, it's energizing, it's pleasurable, like sugar. Lots of people have used tobacco as a weight loss technique. And the solution to all the addictions is to restore normal brain function so that we're not vulnerable. We don't have the cravings because we get the satisfaction that those drugs have been providing us naturally, the way we were designed to get it.
So does the sugar addiction take the onus off the individual and responsibility over what they eat?
It certainly does. If you take quite literally the image that I had of the cocaine powder and the OxyContin powder and the sugar powder as being equivalent, there are very few people in this room or anywhere who don't consider someone who's become addicted to heroin to be in control. And I think that it's a blessing for us to understand that it's not our fault that we've been overeating. We are drugged. It's not within our ability to withstand this level of addictiveness, but we do have techniques to free ourselves. Very few, and they're all in the diet cure.
The next question is, as a parent, what can I do in a sugar-saturated world?
That is a long answer, but the first step is to cure your own sugar addiction, because there is more, there is at least as much sugar consumption going on among parents as among children, and you can't model it. You can't have it in the house. That's the best start you can give your children.
And a secondary question by the same person is, can you speak to PMS and sugar cravings?
People who suffered PMS and the sugar cravings that so often go with them are typically deficient in either progesterone or estrogen or both at that time of the month. And estrogen in particular, estradiol in particular, is very powerful in helping the brain to produce adequate amounts of serotonin and endorphin and to regulate blood sugar. It even has a role. So when we lose that support for our brain chemistry, we go down a notch and lose more control at that time of the month. But we find that over 75% of menstruating women lose all cravings and all PMS symptoms by taking the amino acid supplements, being able to eliminate the sugar, the caffeine, big factor in PMS, and the refined starches, and substituting healthful foods for them. They don't even know anymore that they're going to have a period. In fact, we've had a number of women come in and say, you know, that they were bleeding at work because they didn't get the usual signs. And that's what we're looking for, normal menstruation.
So is sugar really toxic and addictive, or is it just the massive amounts that are marketed to us and pervasive in all our food? In other words, if broccoli were as pervasive and marketed to the same extent, would we be worried about broccoli addiction, and would we be calling it toxic and addictive?
Do I really need to answer that one? The nature of the sugar has changed. It's more addictive since 1970. We found it irresistible, but when we had it, we wanted more, but we just didn't have it, and we forgot about it. You know, so we weren't so vulnerable with sucrose as we are now with fructose added to it. That's for sure.
So you mentioned a need for an increase in saturated fat in addition to animal protein as part of the diet cure. How does this affect cholesterol in individuals who already may have health issues related to it?
By that, I think the questioner is talking about people who have high cholesterol, and saturated fats are high in cholesterol. Just this week, there was a new study coming out about the dangers of statins reducing cholesterol too low, that the cholesterol is a precious, beautiful substance that is used by the brain, all of the hormonal producing glands, to support our lives and the quality of our lives. It's absolutely invaluable, adequate levels, the body actually makes lots of cholesterol itself. It's not most of it actually is made from the body. It doesn't come from the diet, even a high saturated fat diet. So there are some people who have a genetic tendency to make too much cholesterol. They're very unusual, and usually the restriction of fats doesn't help them. They really do need statins. But other people are reducing their cholesterol levels dangerously low, and they're particularly concerned about mood problems, depression, anxiety, and rage. Anger are some of the symptoms of inadequate cholesterol, but there are other health-related symptoms too.
And tying it to carbohydrate overconsumption, that is associated with heart disease as well.
Carbohydrate overconsumption is clearly the culprit with heart disease. It is not fat consumption. In the diet cure, I talk a lot about the studies. I quote the studies, the scientists doing these studies on various diets and how they impact the heart, and they're just flabbergasted that saturated fat really isn't an issue. It's really the amount of refined carbohydrate, sweet and starch consumption that is creating the triglycerides and all of the other problems that really cause heart disease. Dr. Atkins was a cardiologist. He really knew what he was talking about.
Are amino acid supplements addictive? Will the body stop producing their own?
The amino acid supplements are not addictive. As a matter of fact, when you get too many of them, you don't need them anymore, your brain is saturated with these marvelous neurotransmitters, you won't like them anymore. You'll start getting a mild headache, or maybe you'll feel a little jittery or whatever. So they're self-limiting. Nobody stays on them that doesn't need to, you know, because it's an expense and it's a bother to have to remember to take them. And so we just recommend, and I recommend the diet cure, that people take them for a few months and then stop taking them and see when you get to the point where you don't need them anymore. Because if your cravings come right back, that just means you need to take the amino acids for a little longer. And some people who have, particularly who have genetic difficulty like alcoholism in the family, that kind of sugar addiction that's very similar to alcohol addiction, runs in the same family, is virulent. There's a genetic component to it, and typically those people need to be on the amino acids for 1 to 2 years. But that's it. The scientist who developed this knowledge, who did the research on it, about the use of amino acids to stop cravings, didn't know that people could actually completely recover from addiction until he came to our clinic, and there was a TV show, and they interviewed him, and they interviewed me, and they interviewed some of our clients, none of whom were any longer on the amino acids. And his jaw dropped, and he learned, you know, a lesson that science is very excited about right now, and that's the lesson of epigenetics, that our brains are plastic. They can be not only damaged, but they can be restored. And the only thing that can really make the restoration possible is nutrients, specific nutrients that the genetic code recognizes.
So here's a couple of related questions. So is there a certain amount of sugar we can have that's okay? Like one sugar drink a day, or 3 teaspoons of sugar in 1 cup of coffee a day, for example?
Well, okay. Can you stop? Can you leave it at that? Great. The World Health Organization said 10% of our calories. That was about what we were doing in the 60s. We were okay. But if you're one of those people that has 3 teaspoons of sugar one day and then goes to Starbucks, where God knows how much sugar you're getting the next day, and it increases, then it's like an alcoholic who says, could I just have a beer a day? So it depends on you and your chemistry.
Somebody wanted to know if you ever eat any sweets.
You know, I get a headache from sugar at this point. And it just doesn't appeal to me. It's just not interesting. I have what I call a healthy indifference. So it's very seldom.
Is there any risk in giving amino acid supplements to kids or teens?
Well, the dose is critical. And there's a whole chapter just on nutritional supplements and how to dose and how to consider. But so there are some people who are very sensitive. They take, you know, a supplement or a medication and they have a huge effect, you know, just from a small amount. Those people need to start with very low doses. And the same is true with age. The younger, the smaller the dose. So children, you want to open an adult-sized capsule, which is the lowest dose that comes in a bottle, and give them maybe 25% of it. And mix it in a little mashed banana or applesauce or something, and watch the child. It's so much fun. I think I can't resist telling you a child story. We had a young woman who came to us who was a marijuana addict, and we helped her with her addiction, and she became free of her addiction, and she got her daughter back, who was 11, and called us. We hadn't talked to her for probably 6 months to a year, and she said, "Don't worry, I'm okay. I'm still off the pot. My diet is great, but my daughter is becoming a monster. She's attacking me physically. She's opening the door while we're driving. She's too big now for me to really handle physically. I don't know what to do. Can I bring her over?" And I said, "And she has constant tummy aches, and she's gaining a lot of weight that she doesn't need and doesn't like because she can't stop eating sweets and macaroni and cheese." So she brought her over, and they came in, and I gave this little girl once over, and I said, "I hear that you're really angry at your mother." And she raved on for a while about her anger at her mother, and I said, "I have a feeling that you aren't really angry at your mother and that you wonder yourself why you're angry all the time. And I want to tell you that I think it's because a part of your brain is hungry. And I'm wondering if you would be willing to try some of the food that feeds that particular part of your brain." And she said yes. And she chewed up this little tablet, which was about 25% of an adult dose. And 5 minutes later, she walked over to her mother and sat on her lap. And she whispered in her ear. And her mother nodded, and she got up, and she sang us a song. And it was called "You Are So Beautiful in Every Way, No Matter What They Say." I still cry when I tell this story. And she was a belter. They could hear her in the waiting room. Everybody was crying in the whole building. but her mother called me a week later and said, "You know, we were supposed to come back in 10 days, but we really don't need to because that little bit of tryptophan was all she needed. Her serotonin levels are burbling along. She's happy and not angry, and she's sleeping well." And when I asked her if I could take the sugar and the macaroni and cheese out of her diet, instead of crying and going having a tantrum, she just nodded. And she's been off of it now for 4 days. She has no tummy aches, and we expect to see great things from this. So this is a really good example of what we see all the time at our clinic. But the techniques that we use are simple. And that's why I want you to get the books, because they are really self-help books in the best sense of the word. They are very practical, simple strategies that we have seen work over and over and over again. But unless you have a very complex set of issues, you don't need to come to our clinic, but please feel free to.
So someone is asking that they're trying not to take antidepressant meds, and they're hoping that you will help them do that. Can you address that?
The book, The Mood Cure, was really written with people who don't want to take antidepressants or are suffering side effects and would like to get off of antidepressants or are looking at the research on the effects of antidepressants on the fetus and want to get off before they get pregnant. There's a whole chapter on alternatives to antidepressants, and basically, it's simple. We can feed the brain very efficiently so that our levels of our natural antidepressant, serotonin, rise up, just like they rose up in this little girl within days. And if our serotonin levels are normal, we don't need a serotonin reuptake inhibiting drug, because we have a brain that's full and fully functional in terms of producing serotonin. And that means we're not depressed and we don't need an antidepressant. Those people who are on antidepressants, there's a very clear-cut protocol for how to experiment with the amino acids safely while you're on the antidepressants, so you don't risk going off prematurely. Make sure that the nutrients work for you, and then go to your doctor and say, I found these nutrients that make me feel lots better than I was feeling on the antidepressant. Will you now take me off the antidepressant gradually so that I can see if I'm going to be okay without it? And so far, you know, of the people we've worked with, about 95% have been much happier with the nutrients than they were on the antidepressant drugs, even those people for whom the antidepressant drugs had been helpful.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for one last question. So, what is your opinion of the paleo diet?
Well, there are paleo diets and paleo diets. You know, there are the low-fat paleo people who say, well, the wild animals didn't have much fat, so we're not going to have much fat. And then there are others who include more saturated, you know, animal fat is saturated. So I like it. Any diet that is so traditional as the paleo diet, I like it very much. But people do tend to under-eat it. So I always am very careful with people who want to do the paleo diet to ask them to look at the information on the Weston A. Price Foundation website that talks about the importance of saturated fat and the nature of the traditional diet, the caloric content of the traditional diet, and the role of fats in it, so that people don't sabotage themselves. They're eating beautiful, perfect, traditional foods, but not enough of them. So that then they get the stealth cravings, and they're eating the cookies on the side and sneaking things, you know, and eventually giving up on the paleo diet.
Thank you. Our thanks to Julia Ross for her remarks here tonight. We also want to thank our audiences here and on television, radio, and the internet. I'm Laura Brennan Rodriguez, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.